Welcome back to Sunday morning class and our continuing study on Samuel. So I think this is week five? I think it's the fifth week. Getting close to the staple in the book. So it's about half. We're getting a little bit less than halfway through. We're getting there. So anyways, my picture today is from last night's hockey game. I went to the Solar Bears game. It's been a long time since I've been to hockey. But I went with my sister and her friend, and first time for the kids. So we got some good seats right behind the goal, so we got to see a lot of action right there. Not too sure that Jamie's a big fan of hockey, but she had a good time anyways. So today is Samuel the Judge, 1 Samuel 7:14 through 8:9. I thought this picture with hockey might be appropriate because of the judges that are in the picture. Anybody got any ideas who may be a judge in the picture? What's that? The referee. Yeah, the referees. There's three of those. When we started counting, there's more. There's one with the over on the penalty box. There's probably somebody watching their exchanges in and out of the box. There's this guy sitting right behind the screen right here. He watches to see if the puck goes in the goal or not. He botched one call last night, but anyways. The referees, they decide whether the rules are met or not met. They dish out penalties from there. So, yeah, the referees are one judge. How about something else? I might go a little farther on this one. How about the goalkeeper? He keeps the enemies out of their territory. That's the whole idea of the goalkeeper. Protect that homeland. Protect that goal. Keep the puck out. So in that aspect, he kind of acts like a judge too. How about another judge? Crazy fans at a hockey game, probably like any other sport, but they know more than anybody else in the whole place. They're yelling at the ref, they're yelling at the players because they have already judged what's supposed to be happening and what's not. Like I said, you get into any game anywhere, you've probably seen that too. So there's fans that are judges. What's missing in this picture?
Football.
There's a good answer.
How
did hockey get started? I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Hockey is very similar to basketball. It's very similar to soccer. I imagine lacrosse is very similar too. So, I don't know. It's been around for a long time.
Has it?
Yeah.
Balls and ice, probably.
Just about, yeah. Balls and sticks seem to be good times for sports. So. All right. There's no goalkeeper on the other end. The last 5 minutes of the game, they decided they were down by two and they pulled their goalkeeper to put more offensive in. So it was probably a pretty exciting time to see an open goal that long. But anyway, one judge missing. This is my ending, but I put it in the beginning. We are not surprised that Israel enjoyed a period of peace during the time of Samuel. An emphasis on spiritual purity caused the people to turn from idolatry to the Lord. Consequently, they are blessed. Although God does not promise us a life free from difficulty, we may yet enjoy spiritual peace when we learn to rely upon Him, less upon ourselves. We see that in Philippians 4, 6 through 7. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your heart and your minds in Christ Jesus. There are times in life, that's the only way through it. The behavior of Samuel's sons is a black mark on his life. Although he served God and Israel faithfully, Samuel failed at home. This is not to say Samuel is completely to blame for his son's behavior, even so they are not prepared to take his father's place. Parents do well to learn from Samuel's mistake. Noah was not successful in preaching to the people of his day, but he did reach his family. And we'll get to that. Like I said, I should have put those at the end. I usually start with that, and that's when the book... I'll move it to the end later, and I forgot. So, anyways, so what is a judge? We're talking about Samuel being a judge. What's a judge in biblical terms?
Person who tells other people what to do.
Okay, it could be somebody who tells somebody what to do. Yeah, that could be a judge in some aspects. Yeah. But what else?
Makes decisions between two people.
Make decisions between two people, and they bring some kind of disagreement before a judge, and they make some kind of ruling for justice. That the courts are full of that kind of stuff here. Whether it's crimes, where it's, whether it's civil, whether it's, you know, property disputes or marital disputes or anything and everything. We have people in this country, and we've always had people like that, that you take these disagreements before them, and they're supposedly a fair, nonpartisan party that can hash out justice. Okay? Anything else, Chuck?
Well, the attorney of Israel, in response to their enemies, and actually throws the enemies off.
Yeah. Yeah, there's somebody who leads Israel in response to their enemies. They throw off their enemies. They judge Israel back to righteousness. They are already following God. God sends a judge to deliver them from the hands of the enemies.
Clayton? They determine the judgment against the person, don't they?
There's a judgment against
right.
people,
they
too.
Sentence to pay for crime.
Yeah, that's part of the, like you say, that goes along with that justice, okay? We have found you guilty of this crime. Now that penalty is handed out. And some, you know, we don't see it so much as rewards. I guess you do. You see judging Miss America contest, who ranks number one in college football. I mean, basically that's a judging thing too. It's rewards and or penalties. That's handed out. Anything else? I think we pretty much hit it. Holman's Bible Dictionary gives three basic definitions. It's an official with authority to administer justice by trying cases. Or it's one who usurps the prerogative of a judge, or it's a military deliverer in the time between Joshua and David.
Could it just simply be God's way of judging the people that did something against Israel, even though Israel wasn't practicing what was right?
It is. It's that way. He delivers Israel. He punishes. God uses the neighbors. He uses the Philistines to put justice back, you know, to bring Israel back to him. God's really in control. He always is. And that really falls into number two. I got some examples. Moses was a judge in some of this sense, and the official with authority to administer justice. Exodus 18:19-20. Thou obey my voice, I will give you advice, and God be with you. You shall represent the people before God and bring their cases to God. You shall warn them about the statutes and the laws and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do. This is what job God gives to Moses. So he judges the Hebrews in that aspect. Just like you say, with authority to administer justice. In Deuteronomy, and there's other places too that you see these examples, cities had elders. The elders would sit by the city gates, and they became judges. And they would try smaller cases. You would have a dispute with someone, you would take it to them. Deuteronomy 22:15-16, then the father of a young woman and her mother shall take and bring out the evidence of her virginity to the elders of the city and the gate. And the father of the young woman shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man to marry, and he hates her. And there's more to it. But that's whom they take this dispute to, is the elders who sit by the city gates. There's other places. Doesn't Daniel have I think Daniel's got some references when he sit at the city gates. I don't know. There's other places that it's the same way. I'm thinking something happened there because
you had Mordecai.
Yeah, Mordecai.
There's
other examples. I was trying to think of New Testament. I don't think really that works either, though. Anyways, that was one other way that you'll find judges. Basically, elders that sit by city gates and do that kind of thing. King served as a supreme judge. He appointed local judges typically, 2 Chronicles 19:8. Moreover, in Jerusalem, Jehoshaphat appointed certain Levites and priests and heads of families of Israel to give judgment for the Lord and to decide disputed cases they had in their seat at Jerusalem. So these are some, like we usually think of a judge here in our legal system. You see that in several aspects. Number two, one who usurps the prerogative of judge. God's the ultimate judge of the earth. One example of that is Isaiah 33:22. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us. So he has that, he's the ultimate judge. And Christ, as his representative, serves as a judge as well. John 8:16 is one example. Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true, for it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent him. And the military deliverer, you can look in the book of Judges, there's several of them. Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, others. I picked Shamgar because his whole story takes one whole whopping sentence. It's the amazing story. So Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 Philistines with a pointed stick. So that's, you want to find a military guy, a guy that can take on 600 warriors with a pointed stick, he's the man. So, anyways, that's what a judge is. So Samuel's going to be a judge, and that's what we're going to look at today. 1 Samuel 7, verses 4 through 6. So the people of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and they served the Lord only. And then Samuel said, "Gather all Israel at Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you." So they gathered at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord and fasted on that day and said there, "We have sinned against the Lord." Samuel judged the people of Israel at Mizpah. I want to touch on a couple points that Chuck had last week just to set the stage for this week. This is one of the ones he talked about last week. Under the leadership of Samuel, what change occurred in Israel? What was different under him than what was happening under Eli and people before him? Verse 4.
You say God cleaned the house.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really what happened there. God cleaned house. The people started the house cleaning. That's really what starts it. The people, they're changing heart, and God does the rest of it. But they start.
Samuel was the spark that started it.
Yeah, Samuel's the spark. That change of heart, though. They put away their idols. Put away their Baals. They put away their Ashtaroth. They serve only God. And like that, he sets up a worship for them. Anyways, he serves them. He judged the people. 1 Samuel 7:12-13. And Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shin and called its name Ebenezer. And he said, "Until now the Lord has helped us." So the Philistines were subdued and did not again enter the territory of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. As a result of...
These guys are used to losing to the Philistines. Now they're winning.
Yeah, it's this big military turn. Philistines have come in. They whipped on them. Things have turned. Philistines don't even come back. All the days of Samuel, the Philistines stay over where they stay. Chuck had a map last week. You can see the map today. Turn on the news. You'll see Middle East. You'll see Israel. Philistines stay on the coast of the Mediterranean. That's where they were. Today it's Palestine. But that's there. They stayed over there. So that's it. Yeah, that's really the big change. The Philistines were subdued. They don't even come back. They've time and time again come in and raided the place, but they don't come back while Samuel's alive. Moving on to verse 14. The cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron to Gath, and Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. There was peace also between Israel and the Amorites. What land did Israel recover from the Philistines? And what is notable about the cities of Ekron and Gath? Yeah, you got it.
Yeah. Remember the cities they bounced around?
They took the Ark of the Covenant and they took it through these cities and they grabbed a big land grab of Israel. What it is here is they give back the land that Philistines took. Just to sample this in 1 Samuel 5:8-10, parts of it. "Let the Ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." So they brought the Ark of the God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a great panic. And they afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. So these two cities are amongst the cities named where the Philistines had taken the Ark. Once they gave it back to Israel, Israel takes back that land, it takes back those cities that Ark had even previously been in. So, anyways. Same cities. Chuck mentioned those last week. He did a real good job of exposing that part when they stole the ark and how it really didn't work out for them as they thought it would. So anyway, Who are the Amorites? Because it says there was peace also between Israel and the Amorites. We know who the Philistines are, but who are the Amorites?
People from Amor.
People from Amor. That's always the best part, yeah. God's pretty specific on that.
Is that the trouble people in the north?
You know, that's a good question. I didn't even look at the geography. I know they said in the highlands, so up in the mountains and stuff is where they were. So north would probably be, well, I trace it back to Genesis 10, 15 through 18. Canaan fathered Sidon, his first in Heth, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites, and the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Zemarites, the Hamathites. Afterwards, the clans of the Canaanites dispersed.
So there's sons of Canaan, and then they go through Ham. That's all.
Yeah. Right there it is. Noah's sons was Ham. One of Ham's sons was Canaan. The Amorites are Canaanites. When we studied Joshua, and it's been, did I say it was 6 years ago that we studied Joshua?
I think
6 years ago. Week in and week out, we'd stand up here and say, God delivered them against the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Amorites, and you'd go through this, the Jebusites, you'd go through this list of the seven tribes that God delivered. Israel came in, and God pushed out the Canaanites. But we also know that the Israelites didn't wipe out all the Canaanites. They left some of them. The Amorites are some of the ones that were kind of left over. So they're still pests. They live within the borders of Israel. They're still pests to Israel. So anyways, I guess look at Philistines. They're the neighbors. They're enemies outside the borders. The Amorites are enemies inside their borders. 1 Samuel 7:15, Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. So put yourself in the place of an Israelite. The country had peace with God. And it had peace with the Philistines, people who were enemies from outside your borders, people who had come in and taken over land, people who had taken the Ark of the Covenant. And we also had peace with the Amorites, people who, since they took Canaan, they've been fighting with. They've just been pests. But you got peace with all this. How would you feel about Samuel as a leader? All of a sudden there's this peace everywhere.
Well, it's kind of like the United States is looking for that right now. A leader.
Oh, you already saw the next slide? Yeah, okay. Isn't it though? Really? Is that what we're looking for?
Yes. That's what made the country great.
That's what made this country great. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for peace. We're looking for peace with God?
No, we're looking to go back to a foundation.
Okay.
That was built upon a word.
Yeah, we're looking, most people are looking to go back to a foundation that was based on God's word. We're in God we trust. Right. Where a lot of people are looking for that. Are we looking for peace with our...
Well, now you know why this is applies to everybody, even though we didn't grow up back then. Now.
Sure, it does. That's what this study claimed in the study guide. It said, looking at Samuel but applying it to today's world was one of the claims that they were going to try to do. But like you say, you can't help but see that. So what about our external enemies? We got enemies on the outside?
Yeah, we got enemies inside and outside.
You got enemies inside and outside.
Some of those enemies are in the same region as the enemies were back within the world.
they got a bloodline that goes right back to the same people. You're right. There is. There's a lot of that is a bloodline that goes back to the same exact people. But there's external enemies from other places too, obviously. But that's when we're looking for a president, isn't that some of what we're looking for? We're looking for that security, we're looking for that peace. We don't.
Some are,
yeah, that's true. There's always those who aren't. Yeah, people who are joining ISIS from here.
If you think about it, what should a Christian look for in a president?
Yeah, what should a Christian look for?
Well, we'll leave that for another day, but that's a key point.
It is. It really is. Are you looking, when you're looking for president, is it someone who will turn to God for answers? Is Is it someone who will seek peace for his country without...
I think the peace comes with God. So if you seek God, you get the peace by default.
You should. I agree with you. So verse 16 and 17, and he went on a circuit. And he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah. And he judged Israel in all these places. Then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there. And there also judged Israel. And he built there an altar to the Lord. Since Samuel didn't have a cell phone, he didn't have email, he didn't have social media, he didn't even have the Capernaum News Network. Right, Kirk?
That's right.
How did he extend his influence in Israel? Yeah, he walked from place to place. And he probably wasn't there just to shake hands and kiss babies and have $1,000 plate dinner. He was there. He settled disputes. He brought peace. He brought them that comfort of knowing God was in charge.
The roads weren't that good.
Oh, no, I can't imagine the roads were
not that good.
No, it wouldn't have been. It wouldn't have. So he'd go from these places to places on a year by year. He'd make this circuit and go to these different towns and judge Israel. But I'll put it on there. I mean, today's world, I can follow the president on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I can turn the TV on at any time I want to and hear him, see him. People seeking to be president, I can do the same thing. You know, that's just our leaders. You can always see them and hear them. But this, a little different. But he went from place to place, through the year, and through those places. Do you think he maintained his dedication to God that characterized his earlier call to Israel by repentance? Back in verse 3 of 1 Samuel 7, Samuel said to all the house of Israel, "If you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth among you, and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of Israel." Do you think he maintained the same dedication? Do you think he maintained the same kind of message all the time that he was a judge?
I think Samuel did.
Because you can see that they had peace all the way. It was peace with God, it was peace with the enemies. I think he continued that same message. And it seems to be that way. He built an altar to the Lord at Ramah, something that was dear to him, and I would say he maintained his dedication. Just for your own future information, that altar at Ramah, not only does it emphasize his dedication to God, but it'll prepare us for when we meet Samuel, when we meet Saul. That'll happen at that altar. I don't think the text directly says, but we'll see that Samuel's at his home. He goes up to the high place, and that's that. So that's where that'll happen. But I don't think it directly says the altar at Ramah when I looked. But anyways, that's where that'll happen. So moving on to chapter 8. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel. The name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Samuel served God and Israel successfully. So what was the next logical step as he aged? Yeah, find somebody that takes over after him, right? Somebody just, here, let me pass this off. I've done a good job. People are happy. I need somebody to serve God in Israel. I mean, does that make sense? You wouldn't just change ways things happen, right? If things are going smoothly, would you change things? No, you shouldn't. I wouldn't think. But yeah, that's what you would think. You would find somebody to succeed him. Why do you think he picked his own kids instead of somebody else?
He knew them.
Ah, he knew them. Yeah, we do that, right? We pick somebody when we got you need help, you pick somebody you know, somebody you trust. If you got a big job, you wouldn't give it necessarily to somebody you don't know. Sometimes it's the only person that has the right set of skills. But, yeah, there's somebody He knew. He knew his sons. It's a logical thing, too.
Possibly had trained them and instructed them, gave them, you know.
He's got daily touch with them. Yeah, he can train them, he can instruct them, he can show them the way. Some of it without just bringing them in and, come on, we're going to go do this, we're going to go do that. It's just, they're there already. So they've seen what he's done. They've been a part of that all in their lives. They seem like logical successors. But in verse 3, yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned away after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. So how'd it work out?
About the same way Eli worked out.
Exactly. Yeah, same way Eli did. You're right. The guy who trained Samuel, Samuel got the job because Eli's sons were worthless. You got the scripture? Yeah. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. So yeah, it worked out exactly the same way. You think Samuel feared that when he picked his own sons? He knew what happened to Eli's sons. God had them killed. And Samuel, although maybe he wasn't there to see that, he knew it. He knew what happened. Do you think he feared that same thing for his own sons? He'd have to. He'd have to know failure happens. He had to know that they might not work out. Knowing that, what steps would you take? What steps would you take because you any halfway decent parent would want to see their kids fail?
Well, you shouldn't appoint them to the office in the first place. So you have to ask yourself what made them appoint them when apparently you should have known they were worthless, yet he was in denial.
Eli's sons were worthless. Samuel's sons,
I think I don't think it says what we're talking about here at all. Yeah. I think what it says with Eli is they didn't know God at all.
Right.
I think that Samuel brought his children up, so they knew who God was, but they made a choice, as it says, after gain. In other words, they saw greener grass.
Right.
And they decided to turn away from what they knew. I think that's a big difference.
I really do. I think so too. And I've got a question on there. What do you think happened to them? And those choices. It doesn't say. Other than, like you say, Bart pointed out, it says, but they turned aside after gain. You think that's a result that they didn't get trained properly? You think it's a result of they just rejected the guidance they had?
It could have been his wife persuaded him and he didn't really want to. It could have been simply that.
It could be a little of each. It could be none of the above.
But the point is, we don't have a judgment against his kids.
No. But it is worth looking at the fact that what happened there? Because that happens to kids. Is it a result of this? Or is it a result of training? Is it a result of their choices?
The temptation's there.
The temptation is always there. You're right.
And that's another reality of today. As a parent, you raise your children. You hope that they hold on to what you teach them through their life. But we raise them to make their own decisions.
Yeah.
And yeah. They're going to.
They have to. Like this, he appointed them to be judges. If they weren't able to make their own decisions, he was going to have to stand there and guide in their hand in everything they did forever. So yeah, you're right. They have to be set up to make their own decisions. And temptations, they're just bad. I myself have made many decisions. My parents absolutely would not stand by. Not what they trained me to do, not what they would, you know, my decision. And so, yeah, in my own life, I got proper training in a lot of things. I made some rejections of guidance on my own. And like I say, you'll see that with your kids. You see it with Samuel's kids.
Well, like Clark said, and only God can do this, it comes down to motive, because people are always going to be exposed to temptation, and nobody's perfect.
The tempter is around.
What's interesting in this fact, we don't see no judgment against these guys.
No.
That we know of.
Not exactly. You're right. Not like you saw with Eli's sons. Let me back up one. I skipped it. How important is it to develop a faith in our young people that will enable them to carry it on when we're gone? And what are we doing about it? 2 Timothy 2, 1 through 2, "You then, my child, be strengthened by the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and what you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." So what do we do? How important is it to develop a faith in our younger people, and they can carry it on when we're not able? Because that's really what you're seeing with Samuel. He's no longer able to. He's getting older.
It's a responsibility.
We have to, right?
I would say in God's eyes, the responsibility expects you to, as parents, to bring up your kids to know Him.
Yeah. Did Jesus die here on the orange carpet? Did Jesus die right here? He didn't, right?
No.
Were the apostles ever in this room? Did the apostles pick this carpet?
Yeah, we're doing the same thing right now.
I think the apostles may have picked the orange carpet personally. It's been a long, long time. But somehow, from that point, from that day of Pentecost, to today, the church has grown. The church is, that message, the gospel is carried to here. You know, we use PowerPoint. We have heat and air conditioning. It's, you know, it's changed, but the people changed. Where did I learn some of this? From the people, like, well, I learned from here. The people who taught classes. I've had classes with Chuck, Mike O'Neill, many others. You know, I learned the gospel, studied with Mike Wall. Where did those guys learn it from? Who taught them?
And you can take it a little farther when you see the parable of the seed that depends on the ground that the seed falls.
Oh yeah, it, trust me, it depends on where the seed falls and how it's treated. And yeah, we see that. I've worked with the youth here for a long time. And some of them, they sprout and they fall away. Some of them keep on growing. You'll see the parable of seeds, parable of sower, you will see all of that. You'll see that in the adults, you'll see it in the kids. But we have to keep doing that. We keep having to grow them and train them. Otherwise, the church stops functioning, right? It just does.
It should always be on the forefront of our minds as we're raising our kids, because you, first of all, you have to lead by example.
Yeah.
To show them that God is important. That God is number one before everything else. And so as they grow up, they see this, you know, taking place in your life, and you teach them this is why you're doing it, and then they're going to follow your example.
And they see the importance to it, and yeah, carry it on. Carry on the mission. Last week on Sunday, we had four young guys do the table. Wasn't one of us old guys out there leading the way. They just did it. It's not the first time, but that's the kind of stuff that has to happen. Sometimes their words aren't the surest. Sometimes they aren't the most fluent. There might be a little spilled grape juice. But if you ever want to see one of those guys be an elder,
everyone. Do you think God really cares about the presentation, or does he really care about the reason why?
No. And if he did, he'd bless them with that fluent tongue from the start.
Right. We probably all would have been zapped by now.
Oh, yeah.
For presentation.
But one of the hardest things I had to do was replace Paul Sciurro teaching Bible class in the back. There's a guy who taught every Sunday for 10 years, more. There are people that, if Paul ain't teaching, I ain't coming. The days he was sick, the attendance would be down because they knew. And what's it take to replace Paul? Obviously, I can't find someone who's taught Sunday morning class every single Sunday for the last 10 years. And you got to grow them. And that's some of the stuff that we've done. Like I said, some I've worked with, the elders are behind it too. We're starting to put guys, we're making sure opportunities exist to grow this faith so it carries on. So the opportunity's there. And like I said, sometimes it ain't going to be perfect. Sometimes it's pretty ragged, probably, but we're going to work on it. So we've got to. So the church leadership took a turn like Samuel's sons. Guys that looked like they were suited to carry the faith, guys who'd been trained by the best, If the leadership took a turn like this, they started taking bribes, they pervert justice, they even, like we saw last week, changed the way worship is. This is the way God sets it up. When the ark disappeared, we don't know what they did.
Well, it also exposes other people too, because you know there's other people involved in this.
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't snap a finger and just happen, right? So how would we react? What impact would it have on us? How would we react?
They just show how they vote about with their feet.
Yeah, they vote with their feet. The first thing you'd see.
Yep.
It should be. Sometimes they vote for the feet with an influx. You know, depends on what it was.
People influx the people who are crooked.
Yeah, you start noticing in the clientele. Yeah, the body itself would change drastically, whether it's by attrition or a crooked body. Yeah, you should see it. One of the most nerve-wracking things that I started teaching adult Bible classes is, you know, I had very few years of being a Christian, but when I look out and I see how many years some of you guys have been Christians, it adds up to a very long time. And you start adding up, it's hundreds of years, sometimes thousands of years when you add up all your Christianity versus the guy standing here who's not versus being a public speaker. But that's what keeps the church going, is those hearts and that experience.
You know, this is how God shifts the wheat. He allows the prince of the world to tempt people to see what they're truly made out of. And in this case, they took the bribe.
They took it. I can't say God's happy with that. And you see that in the reflection, picking up verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old and your sons don't walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." I'll come back to this. In six, but the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us," and Samuel prayed to the Lord. God said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, they have rejected me for being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me, serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them, show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." God knew all along they'd been worshiping other gods. They'd been following other gods. From the time he brought them out of Egypt, they'd had this problem. He knew it existed. He wasn't happy with it. He said, you know, God's been the king of Israel since before there was Israel. And he says, they want an earthly king? Let them have it. Back up. What are some examples? We'll just hit this one. What are some examples of Israel forsaking God and serving other gods? And I don't think Samuel expected to hear this even to this day. Like I said, they were serving God. Things were peaceful. But he hears otherwise. What are some examples of Israel not following God? Serving other gods.
The fact that his sons were bribed. I mean, something had to start that off.
There's a good point right there. Somebody bribed them. They didn't just, it probably wasn't just a temptation of, hey, we could get money out of these people. Somebody probably offered them something. Or, you know, I'll give you a little of this, you give me a little of that. So, yeah. So the people would have started that. Probably. Chuck?
A good example is when Moses went up on Mount Sinai and talked to God. It didn't take very long for that golden calf just jumped out of the fire.
He's not gone very long.
He's not gone long at all.
He's up on the mountain talking to God, getting them the law to live by, and he comes back and it's like, did you forget who we are? Did you forget who brought us here? Yeah, it didn't take long. It wasn't like something that took 20 years. It was just gone a little while.
Well, it's the same reason.
Sure, they didn't trust God. You know, the spies came back, and there's giants in there. We can't beat them. And the people were like, no, we can't beat them. And they followed the advice of men rather than the two, Joshua and Caleb, who said, God brought us this far, he can bring us the rest away. And they just didn't trust
him. God's just trying to show you that he's the king, but they just don't want to believe it.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much the whole story of Judges as well, right?
It is. Judges has got this circle. Yeah. That they
fall into idolatry, bad things happen, we repent, the judges race, rinse and wash, and repeat.
Yeah. When Joshua finds out that it's his job to take over Canaan, God says the land is vomiting them out. They are such idol worshippers, the Canaanites are, that the land is vomiting them out. By the time of Judges, the people are better idol worshippers than Canaanites were. So, yeah, it's a cycle.
And Doug, too, you know, something I think we don't always contemplate is the length of time that took place between a lot of these events, you know, such as Judges. You know, we see the cycle, and just because, you know, we read it in such close proximity, it sounds like it just happened so very quickly. But when it comes down to it, you know, it's been a long time since I've studied Judges, but I mean, we might be talking about hundreds of years.
Yes, the period of Judges was 450 years.
450. So you think of how long a period of time that is.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, what's the exact birth of the United States now, 253 years?
Somewhere in there.
Look how much has taken place just in the history of this country.
Sure.
And we've only been around about half of the time of the period of Judges. From the technological advances, just the changes in life in general, I mean, a lot of stuff happens in that amount of time.
Yeah, we'd be dissatisfied with the neighbors coming in and taking over for 1 year.
Yeah.
It would throw everything in turmoil, let alone 8 years, 30 years.
Well, think, too, just how the mindset of a people changes. Look how the mindset of the people of the United States has changed over just the past 50 years, 100 years, 150 years. You know, so there's an evolution of the thought of mankind and the way we think and the things that we see as a big deal, the things we don't see as a big deal. And so you span that out over 400 years. You know,
see what it's like.
It suddenly starts to make sense to us. And like, wow, I'm kind of guilty of that myself.
So what if you take 1,000 away from 2016, where you get? That's
yeah.
The dark ages.
Those dark ages, yeah.
So
you go back 1,000 years. Next week, kingship comes to Israel. 1 Samuel 8 through 10. All right, I'll see y'all next week. Thank you.
Hey, Tag Toe.